Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Jim Garrick, Stephanie Hitt, Nick Kacharubas, and Charles Lipsum. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com is where you go to be able to watch and listen to this program or any program that you missed in the past on our website. We're going to have lots to talk about this evening. In hour number one, we're going to be focusing on the events that literally are before us right now, because the sequester deadline, as you all know, is coming up this Friday, March 1st. And what that sequester means, first of all, spending cuts, $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. That's $85 billion this year. Of those cuts, 8% of them are going to be in defense, but it has no effect on any combat personnel. 5% of the cuts are going to come in domestic programs. There will be a decrease in long-term unemployment benefits and a 9.4% almost immediate cut if you're on unemployment. And also, it affects more than 1 million federal workers could be affected by this. But, and this is very important, Social Security, Medicare, and veterans benefits are exempt. So if you are a recipient of Social Security, Medicare, or any veterans benefit, you need not worry about what might be happening on Friday of this week. Nick Kacharubas, thanks very much for joining us from DePaul University, a visiting associate professor there. Do you believe there's any chance that that Congress and the White House will be able to get together to avoid this deadline coming up on Friday?
Not by Friday. I think it's going to be they're going to drag this one out. They had time to do it before, but they've put it off. Why fix it now?
Charles Lipsum from the University of Chicago joins us. Same question, Charles.
I don't think they'll fix it. I think they've had plenty of time. And I don't think either party knows who'll take the major hit on it. I think if everybody knew, that might help.
Speaking of major hit, let's go to Stephanie Hitt. Who's going to take the major hit, Ms. Hitt?
And the major hit will be the president's dire warnings will look like Chicken Little. And I think they are going to take effect, and I think we're going to see that they'll be well managed.
Is it good for the Republican Party long term?
In the long term, I think it is. It is consistent with their message on how to really protect this economy and, in the end, actually support growth.
Is there an obvious winner and loser? Jim Garrick also joins us this evening.
Well, I think the American people may benefit in the long term because of the crisis. I'm a Keynesian finance government to stimulate the economy type fella, but I also believe in balanced budgets. And the difficulty is it's hard to put those two things together, which absolutely must happen. And I think the crisis may manufacture change in policies.
Is it a mistake, Charles, for the administration to be going out with this sort of the sky is falling rhetoric that they've been using for the last several days?
Those of us at the state level have seen this sort of thing before. Whenever things don't get passed, what they threaten to do is close the fire departments and close the police departments and say that chaos will rain down upon us. But the problem is the people, the Republicans at least, want to give the president discretion so that and he will look as if he's playing a game if he doesn't accept the discretion and where the budget cuts will come.
Well, they're talking about at least Ray LaHood, the Secretary of Transportation, when he was on television today. He was talking about inconveniences. He went out of his way to say that the cuts are not going to endanger air safety in any way. But he did talk about delays, and he also talked about maybe there would be some airports that literally would be shut down because they did not want to create a safety issue.
Well, I think the president is definitely has the power of the bully pulpit here, and he has some. He's riding some highs on his numbers, and so I think very much so that he is definitely looking to play a game in the sense of looking to look at these cuts and see what he can do.
His ability to play that game, though, wasn't it hurt rather significantly with the report by Bob Woodward a couple of days ago in the Washington Post, who wrote this long book about how the Budget Act, Control Act came into being. And he was inside the tent when all this stuff was going on. And again, he basically repeated what he said in his book, is that the president signed off on this idea. So
it was his idea.
It was his idea. Jim, I mean, does he have no place to run and hide when you've got, you know, one of the most respected reporters in the country basically calling him out on this?
Well, I mean, the president has a difficult role to play. He's on the one hand trying to repair an economy that was in disastrous condition, where spending for two wars was in place, tax cuts were in place, the middle class was being destroyed, and he's trying to bring back the economy and at the same time try to solve the difficulty of the budget deficit. We have a $3.8 trillion spending proposed by President Obama, and a $900 billion shortfall. Yeah. So that's like 25% of the revenue shortfall.
Yeah, I know, but the plan he agreed to, was if the legislative leaders could not get together and come up with a budget reduction, deficit reduction plan, there would be this thing called sequestering, and sequestering would be automatic cuts. And those automatic cuts were not going to include any increase in revenue. And now he's trying to sort of shift the blame a little bit, and it seems to me that he was called out on it by Bob Woodward.
That's really important to note, is not just the fact that, you know, it came from the White House and the denial of that, not only from him, but also Jack Reed, who's up for the Treasury appointment.
But he was the architect of the idea.
Right. And then the second thing is that now he is, what they say, moving the goalposts, and that is sequestration never involved increased revenue. And in fact, when we were talking about the fiscal cliff back at the, you know, the beginning of the new year, that was supposed to be the discussion of taxes. That was supposed to be off the table, and this is about spending cuts. Now he's saying the only deal will involve tax increases.
But from a political standpoint, beyond the Beltway, Charles, which is where we're supposed to be talking about how they're thinking about things, does anybody really care whether the president is accurate or inaccurate and Bob Woodward is historically putting what was said and whose idea it was in place, or are they just going to say, wait a minute, if I have to go to the airport and the TSA is slow and I'm going to miss my plane, are they going to blame Congress more than the president?
I think the point is that they're going to blame everybody. I think this is a lose-lose situation. The question is who's going to lose the most. I think that the problem for the president is that he really increasingly looks like a tax and spend guy, and there's a question about whether he can manage, and the Republican Congress looks dysfunctional. So they both lose.
1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. I want to get your reaction to the $85 billion in cuts. They may start automatically this Friday. Are you home fearing those cuts? Or are you one of those voters that's home cheering, saying, what's taking them so long? $85 billion, they could probably cut more. 1-800-723-8289. Taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. From Savannah, Georgia to Skokie, Illinois, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Stephanie Hitt, you wanted to make a point about the percentage of these cuts.
Right. You know, we've talked about raw numbers, $85 billion, $45 billion, so on. But what we're looking at in sort of the overall spending budget is, and in discretionary budget, is 2.5%. And I think if we step back, to be honest, as someone who doesn't live in Washington, who doesn't fight these battles, someone who literally sits at my kitchen table every month trying to think of where I can spend and where I can't, 2 cents on every dollar is a manageable amount if we want to ask people and agencies and administrations to figure out how to start looking to cut waste and how to improve the efficiency of their dollars.
Do you agree with that, Jim?
Well, I think it needs to be both. I think we need to increase revenues, and I think we need to reduce expenditures. One of the places I would look for reducing expenditures is the military. The United States military is roughly $760 billion a year. And if you take the next 10 countries and add them up, they're more like $500 billion. Why does the United States have to have 10 times the budget for military of these next countries? I think it's too much.
On that particular point, I think a lot of people would agree with you on what you just said. I think there are probably some Republicans that would agree with you. But if you're an elected Republican, you'd never be able to utter that publicly because, again, the Republicans are generally viewed as the party that has supported the military, although certainly conservative Democrats have done it for, you know, 50 years before the Republicans ever had any power. But my point is, in some way, Nick, does this help? Does this sequestering, does it really help both sides? Because it gives each side an opportunity to say, you know, I really don't want these cuts, but in their heart they know these cuts probably are warranted.
Well, I think it both sides are positioning, and that's what we see going on here. But I want to go back to that point that you made about the president, whether it was his idea or not. We forget the idea that the Republican-led Congress actually did vote this through, and I think in this, and they said we're going to agree to this as well, and so they've got some pressure on their feet too. So both sides are trying to hold each other to their feet to the fire, and it's who's going to back down first. And if, at the end of the day, I think the president has the bully pulpit, as I mentioned earlier, on his side. And so yes, both sides have an ability to make themselves look better.
But the reason the Republicans held fast and the reason they went to the sequester was they stood firm as a party in the House saying we're not going to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. So if this becomes if the level of inconvenience or God forbid there is some, you know, catastrophic event that takes place that the media will quickly or one of the parties will quickly track back to, you know, a lack of funding with sequestering. I mean, it seems to me that the Republicans will again, the way the story will be spun in the media by the Democrats and by their friends in the media is that it was the Republicans' desire to protect their wealthy base and not raise any more taxes. That's why, you know, the sky fell, and that's why, you know, the planes collided.
And I think that's why you see the president doing what he's doing now with the campaigning. And, you know,
But let's not forget, we just went through the fiscal cliff. We had that tax talk. And guess what? Taxes increased. They've hit. And everyone's really feeling it. So then we're going to ask them to feel it some more. The reality of what taxes do to the economy was shown very quickly from January 1 to today, where already we're seeing a huge decrease in economic growth. People are feeling it in their payrolls. So it is a legitimate line to hold firm, and that is on not raising
Charles,
taxes.
Stephanie was right earlier when she said that this is not large in the grand scheme of things. The problem is we've been running this government for a couple of years on continuing resolutions and the short term. When you say all of a sudden we may have a sequester, we may not, you can't plan even a small business around things, much less something that's as big as the United States. I think that the risk for President Obama is not so much that it's not even that he looks more and more like a tax and spend person. The main risk to him is that he owns the economy, and this economy has not performed well for 4 years, and if it continues to perform poorly, he owns it.
But
yeah,
he owned the economy when voters went to the polls in November, and he was reelected.
If he had run unopposed, he might not have won, but he had to run against Mitt Romney.
Want to comment on that?
You know, I think we can go back to November, but looking forward, I think that's where both parties are looking and saying the next election is a congressional election. And I think the president's saying, if I can pin this on the Republican Party and the Republican Congress, I may get a Democratic Congress. The Republicans, I think, are doing the same thing, saying, if we can hold fast, we might be able to pick a seat. And so we have the election all over again.
We have constant elections.
Right, and the nature of congressional elections are that they are very district centric. And so Republicans, you know, they know what their constituents need to hear and say, and stay, you know, keeping down taxes and cutting back.
Yes,
that's why they were reelected.
There's a big battle within the Republican Party about how much they want to really be hardline on that. They took some lumps from being too closely associated with the Tea Party, and I think that there is a battle within the Republican
Party. But how many people are going to lose? How many people are going? How many members of Congress are going to lose a race if they say to their constituents, "I did not raise your taxes"? Isn't that still a winning card to play?
I think you are absolutely right. I think the fact is the president went to the well on raising taxes before. I think trying to raise them this time around is a step too far.
Let's go to Colton listening to us tonight in Savannah, Georgia on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead. Colton, are you there?
Yes. Hey, sorry, I lost session.
That's okay.
I appreciate you guys letting me on. I am a center-right Republican and listen to y'all's show very often. I just wanted to know, you know, you guys are talking about, you know, obviously the sequestration that, you know, coming into effect this Friday, and going back and forth on the, you know, the short-term winners and losers. I just wonder, and I know there's a lot of talk about this, you know, 10, 15 years from now, if we're at $25, $30 trillion debt, you know, what is the number when you know, if we sustain or keep at this pace, when we really start to feel it? And when we look back and see that, you know, these were such small little battles that we couldn't come together on or work up something.
I think you put your finger right on it, Colton. These are small. These are small, but they're indicative. If you can't deal with these modest amounts without and actually make cuts without raising taxes, how are you going to deal with the bigger issues? And I think you're exactly right on that. I just want to emphasize one more issue. We're trying to do all of this without any economic growth. You just can't cut your way out of this. We've got to get back growing again.
I want to ask Jim a question. We should mention, by the way, in the second hour of this evening, we're going to be talking about an issue that is near and dear to Jim's heart, and that is reform and, in some cases, prohibition or ending the prohibition against on the war on drugs. But that's a big, big idea. That is a big, huge, controversial idea. It's an important part of your life. Do you have any confidence that legislative leaders, either in Washington or in state capitals, can take on big, big issues when you see the way they've acted over the last 3 to 5 years?
I think that the American people are looking to both the Republican and Democratic Party to start talking seriously about issues which they have been unable to talk about, whether it's because of a political reason or getting reelected. We have people who are earning over $10 million a year in the United States, where the taxes that they pay, over half of the money comes from dividends and capital gains, and they're paying at 15%. Whereas someone who goes out and works for $40,000 a year ends up paying a rate of like 25% of what they're earning. So that they, on the revenue side, it's unfair to leave those facts as they've been with Bush cuts. We have defense, where we have bases around the world where we make Rome look like a piker. Where we have to say that we don't need 8,000 drones, which we have at the moment in the United States. We don't need, I forget the number of military bases, but we're everywhere. We need the Democrats to say, well, we really have to look at entitlements. Should somebody be able to earn a pension and then go, after 20 years, go somewhere else, earn another pension, pyramid the pensions, collect both pensions, and then go get a third job where they're earning
and get Social
because
Security.
They're working and Social Security. Our pension system, Illinois is a great example. We end up with this $90 billion, $100 billion unfunded liability for pensions. The same kind of thing is going on nationally, where we incur debt and commitments that we can't pay for.
Stephanie, address some of Jim's points.
Well, yeah, this is exactly. Before getting into the military and what I think is our need for a strong military and security around the world, I want to talk about Bruce, you talked about do we trust federal and state legislators? I actually think we need to separate these, because I think we can look around our country and see, in fact, that governors have handled these kinds of crises. We've got quite a few examples. Right next door in Wisconsin is another a perfect example. But we're looking at states that had horrible, horrible deficits, like Michigan and Pennsylvania, places like this. New Jersey is making a turnaround, where governors are faced not with a 2.5% cut, but some places 10 to 26% budget cuts. And they've been able to turn their states around. They go through with the scalpel. Remember, that's the same scalpel that Obama promised in 2008 he would use. They've gone through. They can do it at the state level. They've proven that there are ways with much bigger cuts and much more at stake.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about the sequester. $85 billion in cuts this year. They're supposed to start happening effective on Friday. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Before I reintroduce our guests, let me mention that if you're within the sound of my voice living in Chicago, we have five more days through the 28th of February. It'll be free admission to the museum during our Harold Washington On the Air retrospective. Again, we're open from 10 in the morning till 5 p.m. if you want to come down and see the museum and see an example of the charismatic character called Harold Washington, who was Chicago's first black mayor. You can come and do that. Again, it's free until the end of the day on the 28th. Joining us right now, Jim Gehrig is here. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's a former Cook County prosecutor. And again, we will talk in the second hour of this evening about things that are near and dear to his heart, which is to basically crack down and end, no pun intended, to end the war on drugs. Nick Kacharubas also joins this evening. He is a visiting associate professor of politics and or public administration at DePaul University, and also he is an elected official in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Charles Lipson also joins us, the pride of Marks, Mississippi, longtime professor over 30 years at the University of Chicago and a regular guest here on this program. And Stephanie Hitt also joins us. She is a mother of three, and she is mother of four. I keep saying three.
Yeah.
Please apologize to your fourth child. A mother of four.
Varies which we're day now, I want to get rid of one, but yeah.
You're going to pick the three, four you want. But anyway, we also a graduate of Wellesley and the University of Virginia Law School. Let us go to calls. Let's go to Steve listening to us in Youngstown, Ohio on WKBN, the Big 57. Nice to hear from you tonight, Steve. Go ahead.
Evening there, Bruce. Hey, first, you know, let me use Woodward's words, semi-quoting Ezra Klein, the American people moved the goalposts. But having said that, Obama has done a lousy job of pointing out how he wants to avoid this, you know, very destructive meat axe approach, which, of course, is going to really harm the economic recovery. And we all know that he's been campaigning for a year and a half on a trillion point, like 2 to 4 increase in taxes through the balanced approach of small rate increases on the top and closing these loopholes. But he hasn't solved these loopholes. Certainly not since the election, certainly not since the fiscal or the, yeah, the fiscal cliff.
Well, he wasn't very specific in the State of the Union either.
No, that's right, and that's right where he should have been, you know, really, you know, laid it out again, is that, you know, hey, you know, we've got these, you know, people, the largest corporations, the richest people who are getting away with tax rates that the rest of us aren't getting away with. The effective tax rate on the top 500 corporations is 12%. And, you know, we've got Romney as an example. He's paying 11%. They've got these special tax rates, these loopholes, these exemptions, and, you know, outright subsidies. And this is where Obama's really fallen off the wagon here.
As you, Steve, as you look at what is possibly going to happen, or likely to happen, I guess, at this moment, on March 1st, do you and the people that you deal with on a daily basis, are you cheering that there's going to be these cuts?
course not. I'm cheering for economic recovery. My life depends on it. My livelihood depends on it. And all this crap is just making everybody hold on to everything. And this is the game. Is Obama slow or what? I mean, the game the GOP has been playing is let's obstruct economic recovery however we can without making it look too dramatic. You know, really getting the blame laid on us.
Nick's got a comment for you, as do our other guests. Nick?
I just want to jump on. You had said, you know, it doesn't look like Obama, and I would agree with you as a leadership scholar. As a leader, I don't think that Obama is leading through this. I don't think Obama is trying to avoid this in any way, shape, or form. I think he, from a political, though, advice perspective, this is what he wants because he's got some political capital to spend coming out of the November election. If he's going to use it, now's the time. Is
why
this the battle to
want,
use it? I don't know.
I mean, why would you not want you've got to know that the cuts by themselves are going to take, what are they saying, maybe as many as a point off of GDP, a little more than a point, and just the whole idea of, you know, the uncertainty.
That's
why
right.
Would you,
Charles Lipson is next.
Steve, you put your finger on it. I think that the uncertainty has just been awful, and it's been awful over a whole range of issues for about 2 years now. People haven't known what the health care law was going to do. In fact, there's still a lot of uncertainty about the law because we don't know how the regulations will roll in. A lot of continuing resolutions so that we haven't known what government budgeting will be. The Senate hasn't passed a budget so that everything has been done on a very ad hoc basis. And one of the things that we really do know about the effect of the federal government is that uncertainty over taxes, over regulation, really creates problems. And it creates problems because people like Steve, who have to make decisions, don't know the environment that they're facing.
Stephanie.
Well, and I think, you know, the other thing is it is uncertainty. But here's the other thing is it's also lack of leadership. And you know, we do have a Congress that, you know, they have actually put forth a couple proposals that they voted on for spending cuts. And we have the Senate, Democrat-controlled Senate, that has taken up none of this, along with the president. You know, part of this, too, is that, Steve, I know you talk about economic uncertainty. Bruce asked you, are you cheering these cuts? I'm asking you, are you fearing these cuts? What are you?
I am. And,
what
and
are you feeling? Are you more afraid of these cuts than you are of increased taxes?
No. You see, I'm with Krugman. I believe that we've got to raise some taxes. We do have the deficit, but we don't need to do this meat axe stuff. And I do believe that the Democrats have proposed the right thing. They're just not fighting for them.
Jim Garrick's got a comment.
You know, we're talking about a sequestration that could have the effect of a cut across the board of 2.4%. 2.4% when the federal deficit in spending is 25% short of the revenue needed to pay the bills. So this little cliff, this sequestration that we're talking about now is still minutia compared to the extent of the problem. Don't worry about the uncertainty that we have. The markets are down in Europe because we don't know what we're going to do here with this thing. That's a factor, but that is minuscule compared to the amount of revenue shortfall that we have.
We're going to move on to Mike in Spokane, Washington, listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead.
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for taking my call. Home of Bing Crosby and Gonzaga basketball.
You
number
got
three
it.
In the country.
You got it.
Number two, we hope. But today there are no concessions from Democrats or Republicans on the budget. And, you know, as you mentioned, Bruce, those on unemployment will be hurt further while the wealthy can continue to use the tax loopholes. And while I am a Democrat, strong Democrat, I didn't vote for Obama this time because of his infringement of religious freedoms.
Okay. Let's go to Bob in Boise, Idaho, listening to us on KBOI. He's got a suggestion. Go ahead.
Oh, I think if all of the, I mean, the Obama administration is big about rich people, taxing them and punishing them. Maybe the federal employees that earn over $100,000 should take an immediate 5% pay cut and have it progressive as it goes up. As you earn $200,000 working for the government, it becomes 30% pay cut. And you would reach the $85 billion in a short period of time.
Oh, I think philosophically it's a good idea to have federal employees that are, and I don't know how many are at that level. I'm sure there are many, but I don't think that your math adds up.
Really?
No, I don't think there are that many federal employees that are earning in excess of $100,000.
25% of federal employees earn more than $100,000.
Well, there are a lot of innovative ideas about how we could cut the budget, but the basic point, which is...
But none of them come out of Washington.
None of them, that's for sure.
They all come from callers to talk radio shows.
Jim,
that's where they
Jim
come from.
Jim has raised the key point. We're just spending far, far more than we're taking in. Why is that? Well, part of it was for a short, sharp downturn about 4 years ago. But the main problem is that we've just vastly increased spending far more than we've increased revenues. And the big debate is, should we cut back the spending to its normal trajectory over a very long period of American history, or should we raise taxes to a new, unprecedented
high? The reason we're in this is that we have a political system where one party has mastered the ability to expand their base by giving more goodies to their base, expand it, and the only way that the Republicans try to catch up is the Republicans come up with their own goodie program, their
exactly.
prescription drug program. They come up with their loopholes and their subsidies for the farmers of the country. Both parties are trying to outdo each other to deal with their political bases. Bidding with our money, and that's where we are, and that's why we are in this mess right now. Because
exactly.
the people who are in charge of the cookie jar here, they don't know how to fix it.
And nobody wants to give anything up.
And nobody wants to give anything up. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to Markham, Illinois, where John is listening to us on 89 WLS Radio. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. Bruce, I love the show. I love it every week. We're not talking about cutting government at all on either party. What the sequester is slowing the rate of government growth. Until everyone can get together and acknowledge that with the GDP growing at 2%, increasing the government at 4% is a bad idea, it is just perpetuating this problem that the government gets bigger and bigger and bigger no matter what the growth is.
But sir, if you are furloughing federal employees, aren't you reducing costs? If you don't know when they're coming back, isn't that a real reduction?
If you were truly, the last time they shut down the government in 96, 97,
yeah.
all those employees were laid off for 3 weeks. When they came back, even though they didn't show up for work, they got paychecks for those 3 weeks that they didn't show up. That's the problem.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
there's nobody, and guys, let me... Has a blue-collar, owner-operator, independent guy? Nobody is addressing what the rest of us are going through out here because everyone is tied in working for the city, the state, the county, the township, the municipality. The big joke, guys, I'm out of Chicago. The biggest joke in the world is, hey, if you need to go to Chicago, go on a government president's holiday. because you can roll a bowling ball down the Eisenhower, down the Stevenson, down the Ryan. Let's actually address these issues. Let's be honest about it. Let's not hide behind the
fact. How would you do it, John? How would you do it? And how do you want your member of Congress to do it?
Well, you have to reduce regulation and increase growth, which right now our president, through his ideology against carbon, against energy. Guys, if we put in that pipeline, if we make every CTA bus run on natural gas, every school bus on natural gas, there are 5 or 6 million jobs in the next 6 months.
Well, one of the things I think
Stephanie Hitt's got a comment for you, John.
I'm wondering, John, are you sort of hinting at one of the things that we're seeing is we're talking about cutting 2% of, you know, a budget that is more than twice what our budget was 10 or 12 years ago. That's how much our government has grown. So in a sense, I mean, there will be some people who say, well, this is minuscule. Does it even matter? But on the other hand, we have to start somewhere. And but I'm wondering, when you say you're feeling it, are you personally, in your job, in your career, are you going to feel the effects of sequestration?
No, I'm feeling the effect of the Obama recovery for the last 4 years.
That's what I was yeah. saying.
And is that due to taxes?
That's why I'm on Medicaid. That's why I can't make a living. In 2008, doing exactly what I do, I could gross $180,000 a year, and I could pay for my own stuff. The administration now has set the tables where myself and fellow brothers in the Teamsters, in the trades, pipe fitters, electricians, iron workers, steel workers, where now we have to turn to the safety net because we're not allowed to make what we can make. Because instead of looking at growth, because everyone wants to be so negative about trickle-down, you know, I want to
underscore three things that you said. First, it was just very clear from your talking how much pain you're suffering. And I think you're speaking for a lot of people out there. The second thing is I think you're absolutely right in saying that it's not just the budget, it's also the accumulation of regulations. Regulations never come off, they only come on, so it just accumulates year after year after year. And people can't figure out how to set up a factory, what they have to do. And the final thing is that I think that you've put your finger on the big problem, which is the lack of growth. And it's not 1 year or 2 years in a recession. It is slow growth over a long period of time.
John, I want to ask you one quick question because it's going to set up the discussion in the second hour. I need a short answer. Representing, again, you were articulate and you have that blue-collar passion that we appreciate on this program. Would you support ending the war on drugs?
No.
You would not. Okay. First vote. We're going to talk more about it in the next hour. Thank you very much for being with us for that call. We are out of time in our first hour. Joining us, we've had Jim Garrick has been here, and Charles Lipson has been here, and Nick Karoubas has been here, and also Stephanie Hitt. They've all been here. They'll all be back for the next hour. If you're listening to us on radio from coast to coast, we're going to be talking about the war on drugs. Is it time to stop the war on drugs? That's the discussion in the second hour of our broadcast this evening. If you're watching us on television, you'll see the discussion in a couple of weeks. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for being with us. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. And if you want to get on the line right now, whether you're pro or con, we're going to be talking about drug legalization. And we're also going to be talking about the over-incarceration in this country. All coming up in the next 1 hour of Beyond the Beltway. Hop on the line now, 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Jim Garrick, Stephanie Hitt, Nick Kacharubas, and Charles Lipson. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. Well, for the next hour, we're going to be talking about the war on drugs, whether we are winning the war, whether we are losing the war. And we have one guest here this evening who thinks it's time to end that war. And we want to get your reaction to it. We'll get reaction from our other guests as well. James Garrick is with us. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He was a former Cook County State's Attorney, and he has made this his life's work over the last decade. Jim, nice to have you with us. You've been a guest on this program many, many times in the past. Why do you want to end the war on drugs?
Bruce, let me start out by saying I am opposed to drug use. That said, I am more opposed to the war on drugs. And the reason is, even as a former drug prosecutor, I want to make two points. Number one, the war on drugs doesn't work. Prohibition takes something that grows on a plant and makes it the most valuable commodity on the face of the earth. So we end up with more drugs, uncontrolled and unregulated, because of prohibition. Not only does the war on drugs not work for its intended purpose, but secondly, it's the heart of nearly any crisis you can name in America. The problem with guns, gangs, crime, prisons, taxes, deficits, AIDS, health care, trade imbalance, corruption, no money for schools, job programs, the funding of terrorism, all made worse because of the war on drugs. The third point I want to make, not only does the drug war not work, two, it's the heart of any crisis you can name, three, why is something that's failed so mightily, why has it been in place for 40 years when the prohibition of alcohol was only in place for 13 years? And the answer is the good guys and the bad guys are both on the same side of the line of scrimmage. The fastest growing industry in housing in the United States during the 1990s was prisons. Clinton says we need to hire 100,000 more policemen. We forfeit the drug dealers' money, and now it becomes the property of the police. So that the police are in favor of it, the parents are in favor of it. Radio and TV gets $400 million a year in anti-drug advertising. So the probation officers, the parole officers, the drug court, all these people are benefiting. So Al Capone's in favor of prohibition, and so is the good guy.
Stephanie Hitt also joins us. You are a mother of four. You are a Republican. You're a conservative. Graduate of Wellesley in the University of Virginia Law School. Right. Your reaction to this rather strong indictment that James has just made?
Well, listening to, the arguments and the connections with all these other horrific crimes, it sounds compelling on one level, but, we need to step back and say, what are we talking about? We're talking about drugs. And there is a very important line we need to think about is we're talking about normalizing and making more accessible through legal channels something that is devastating to people. Now, I don't understand pharmacology in great detail, but I do know that there's a difference between alcohol and cigarettes and what we might go down the path, marijuana and other things, and it's mind altering. And do we want to have a society? Are we going to give the moral approval to allowing people to alter their minds and alter their behavior?
Charles Lipson also joins us. I want to get your reaction to what Stephanie just said. Are we sending a moral okay if we legalize drugs?
I think that the basic story here is that drugs are not generally good in society, but I agree with Jim that the war on drugs has been even worse. We've criminalized a lot of ordinary activity. We've made it very rewarding to build up criminal gangs. And if you've read President Obama's memoirs, his autobiographies, if he had been pulled aside by police, he would have been potentially convicted of felonies for what a lot of kids in high school have done. What would that have done to his career? You can like President Obama.
Well, a lot of Republicans would say
that. No. But this is a person
who's just lost 45% of the audience.
Yeah. This is a person who's gone on, and I must say, the hypocrisy in that I find really quite staggering.
George Bush.
How he can go on, and George Bush before him,
right,
can go on after their own histories,
and make
people felons. I just don't understand.
Nick Kacharubas also joins us. Nick from DePaul University, visiting associate professor. Go ahead.
I would have to agree on Stephanie on the moral issue. I do think that I'm not a hard line on this. I think economically, people look at the benefits to it, and I don't like what it does to our prison systems and what it does. And I'm not talking about the one-time use type of situation, but I am talking about a legalization mechanism where, you know, we're talking about major problems of growth in this country, and I can't step aside from the mind-altering.
But as a conservative, and I think it's safe to say you're a conservative, and your expertise is in public service and public administration. That's what you teach.
Yep.
Can you disagree with Jim that looking at it objectively, the war on drugs has not been a success?
You know, I don't have all the information that Jim has, because that's not my expertise. I can tell you, as a local elected official, we struggle with this issue, whether we leave it as a criminal issue or whether we make it a civil issue. And we've chosen to keep it a criminal issue.
And you're from Crystal Lake. What happens in Crystal Lake if you're...
Crystal Lake, it's considered a criminal offense. It's left up to prosecution. The option before us...
Do they actually prosecute?
They do. Most folks... you know, obviously have to go before a judge, but that whole process we felt was strong enough as an educational piece of our society that we didn't want to. There's an economic cost to doing that. But at the end of the day, though, I guess I would just say that our other option is to make it equivalent to a ticket. You know,
Jim.
See, we talk about the moral issue, and Stephanie talks about increasing access. We started out with 2% pure heroin when I was a prosecutor in the early 70s as the best heroin in Chicago. 40 years of drug war later, you kids can now buy 90% pure heroin in nickel and dime bags, which is easier to get than cigarettes or a carton of beer. We talk about the moral issue. Well, drugs are bad, so we want to, you know, everything in drug policy works in reverse. You say drugs are bad, so let's criminalize them. Drugs are bad, so let's try to keep the price high. Drugs are bad, so let's put anti-drug advertising on TV. The ad on TV is a drug ad. What do you say, use the drug or don't use the drug? The kids who go through their program have a higher rate of drug use than those who don't. 80% of the murders in Chicago are from gangs who make their living in the drug trade. Al Capone was in favor of prohibition. How can a moralist be on the same side of prohibition as Al Capone and the drug cartel?
What's a good question, and we're going to let Stephanie respond, and we have lots of callers on the line already. 1-800-723-8289. We have a man here tonight. He wants to end the drug war. He's made his case. Do you buy it or reject it? Back shortly from Chicago. From St. Louis, Missouri to Caldwell, Idaho, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Let's go to Bob, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, you're on the air. I'm sorry, Jeff. Jeff, go ahead. Are you there? Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to go with the guest that wants to, the guy that wants to... throw this war on drugs out. We've been doing this since Reagan, and the problem is I want to connect it to real quick to the incarceration, because I myself 12 years ago was incarcerated for a probation violation, maximum security prison, and many of those guys in there were in there for what I was in for, very stupid stuff, and maybe growing marijuana, maybe some drugs, either having drugs or dealing drugs. And the prisons, unfortunately, the more people they have in there, that's how they get paid. They have to have a busload of prisoners. That's how they get paid, like the guest was saying. And the other point was is that we are not, no one mentioned the legal drugs that the doctors are prescribing that are very dangerous right now, that are legal, that we're giving either to our kids or to people that take prescription drugs. And I think this is a huge waste of money for the American people to keep doing this, because basically we get a drug bust and we get like 1% of what's coming over the border.
Jeff,
or whatever.
Jeff, how do you, what is your reaction to Stephanie's position that to legalize this, you're basically you're obviously throwing up your hands, you're giving up, and you somehow are either you're condoning it or you're turning a blind eye to something that a variety of people, a number of people, for many, many years have said will hurt you. It will hurt you or hurt your son, hurt your daughter. It is not a
right.
Just as alcoholism is not a positive thing for society. And again, we should remember that, you know, the reason behind prohibition was because there was massive drunkenness in America. There was widespread public drunkenness. And prohibition, although it lasted for 13 years and it led, the unintended consequences are absolutely correct as Jim has stated them. The reality is the issue that that propelled this and gave it popular appeal, public drunkenness and alcoholism in America went down during that period.
That's right.
So
right. Well, I would say to the lady is that I have four kids. I'm a conservative Catholic. And what my thing is that we are we as parents, I had my kids, some of them on drugs for a long time. I had to deal with that. I understand that dilemma there because I had to deal with that when they were teenagers. But the reality is that we have wasted millions of dollars, like Jim said, on the advertising, on the other stuff. We've wasted the money when we, and then you guys should talk about this, but talk about the judges and the sheriffs that would want, most of them, that when the drug case comes into the court, they don't want to send them to prison. They want to get them help. They want to get them off the drugs. And the sheriffs, most of the sheriffs, a good majority of them, want to legalize marijuana. Why? Because they don't want to throw in somebody in prison with people that are murderers.
Okay. Stephanie and Charles both have a comment.
And Jeff, I understand that, but then I think what we're talking about is not necessarily legalizing it, but let's look at the war analogy and let's not change the mission, let's change the battleground, let's change the tactics. It doesn't mean by legalizing it, I do believe that you're condoning it. You're going to make it accessible on a different level and you're normalizing it. But maybe the real question is to talk about the kind of penalties and things like that. Those are legitimate kinds of ways.
Well, those things
are
going
on right now.
And
it's not
by
saying it's okay. And I think that might be the issue.
Jim, I have to say, you keep thinking that if you legalize, control, and regulate drugs, you're going to have more of them. And the answer to that question is because of the Al Capone, United Nations drug policy paradigm. When I was in Mexico City giving a speech a year ago, the police seized 13 tons of meth in one bust. Prohibition is the most effective way to put more drugs uncontrolled and unregulated everywhere. In the United States, marijuana is the largest cash crop. Mexico produces 121,500 tons of marijuana a year, which gets shipped to this country. 2 miles down the street from my house in suburban Cook County, Mexican drug cartel plants 6,000 marijuana plants in a forest preserve district where people who are sick and can't get medical marijuana are suffering. It's idiotic.
Well, I know, but you have to get – there's a very, very important line, and that is, why should we control and legislate and open doors of access to something that is proven to be harmful? People's lives – you know, let's look at the cost of drug use, and that is people's lives are altered.
You're missing the
here's
point.
Charles, next.
I think the reason this is so hard is that some of what each of you says is at least in my mind, quite correct. That is, I think Stephanie is right, that if you legalize it, it does send a moral message. I think that if you legalize it, it brings the price down and it makes it more accessible. On the other hand, it seems to me that the biggest cost now has been that we have incentivized international drug cartels, and we've criminalized a lot of consumer behavior. It seems to me that different people are going to put a different weight on that. Right now, it seems to me that the weight of it is really that it hasn't worked. We've had a war on drugs. Drugs won.
Nick.
You know, Jim, if I use your logic, and I do have to agree with Stephanie, if the metrics are wrong, but if I use your logic, if we look at the city of Chicago, we're spending more on crime and police protection, but yet the murder rate has gone up. Maybe we should just get rid of the murder laws as well.
And the solve rate of the murder cases has plummeted to 25% because we assign the police officers to go work drug cases, stand there and try and observe consensual behavior between adults who choose to buy and sell substances and want to decide what to put into their own bodies. We have destroyed law and order. We have destroyed respect for all morality. We have police officers who engage in the same activity. We just had three Schaumburg police officers arrested for selling drugs, stealing the drugs from the drug dealers, and then themselves going to sell it, and then arresting the guys for less drugs than they
had. I want to take another call. Drew in St. Louis listening to us online. Go ahead. St. Louis, nice to hear from you tonight. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
First of all, I'm actually a high school teacher, and I also – write an education blog, and this past week I wrote about how the war on drugs affects education, and I used Chicago's public schools as my example. And what I basically argued was that schools are just going to be as good as their prospects, and most of the people in those really poor performing schools, they see the advantages of becoming a drug dealer as opposed to going to college. If the war on drugs ended, all those drug dealers would be put out of business because there's no way they could ever compete with Walgreens or CVS in the free market. Mass production will destroy them because they are not smart enough. And that's the key thing here. We need to be looking at how to make sure that the drug dealers, these violent people, are the ones that are suffering. And to
what about the argument? I want you to address the argument that was raised on the other side by Stephanie that it would legitimize use among your students, some of whom would otherwise not be inclined to use it.
Well, Stephanie, I am a libertarian conservative myself, and I find it almost laughable that you as a conservative will say that you believe government has the obligation to be to push morality on people. I'm sorry, but that is absolutely insane in my view.
Well, you know what? I mean, let's be real here. I mean, society's come up with social norms, acceptable behavior, what they think is right. We have no problem legislating and saying murder is wrong. And so there's no reason that we cannot say that the havoc that people can wreak upon their own bodies and the damage that it does to society when people are in mind-altering states and they do it for recreational purposes, we as a society are. We are able to go ahead and draw those lines. Now, one of the things we aren't talking about is we talk about the costs of prosecuting and incarceration. We can even take a look at Northeast Europe, for example. Let's look at the true cost of legalized drug use, where there is normalization of it. What you do see in a lot of these societies is less work, employment issues, There's also health issues.
Some of those
there's things like that. I know, but my point is there are costs associated
to
too much drug use. And those have to be legitimate.
Jim.
And then are we protecting drug use? Is it now protected under the ADA?
Jim Garrick.
Portugal in the year 2000 legalized all drugs. They decriminalized them. And the results were that there was less drug use, less drugs available, less unemployment, less crime, less of everything that we're trying to accomplish. By doing the exact opposite of the war on drugs that's pushed by the United States on the rest of the world and the United Nations on the rest
but
of the world.
But it's not the perception of what happens in Amsterdam, and we'll talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Also, Jim is soon going to testify before the United Nations, and he wants to talk about their role in the international war on drugs. He's against that also. Back shortly from Chicago. Bustamante back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. James Garrick is here this evening. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He wants to end the war on drugs. Nick Kacharubas joins us. He is a visiting assistant professor at DePaul University. He supports the war on drugs. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago joins us, and he's somewhat neutral, sort of opposed to the war on drugs, but also you're waving the moral banner from time to time in your discussions as well this evening, being very professorial and taking sort of both sides of this discussion.
Why, thank you, Bruce. Like thank you.
Also joining us this evening is Stephanie Hitt. She is a mother of four and a conservative Republican, and all important credentials for, I guess, this discussion this evening. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number, and we're going to get back to discussion, but let's go to calls. We've got a lot of people standing by. Let's go to Caldwell, Idaho. Robert is listening to us on KBOI. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Okay.
In my opinion, I think that a lot of this money could be moved to money used that our federal government's using to fight drugs could be moved over to securing our borders. We're fighting a war, in my opinion, that we're funding. We don't have, in all states, mandatory drug tests for people on unemployment, which any financial support group funded by the federal government, you have people out there not working, and the first of the month comes around, they get their check, their food stamps, and people sell their food stamps for cash, and they buy drugs. We're funding something we're trying to fight, and you can't beat a system if you're just feeding it at the same time, in my opinion.
All right, let's let Charles respond on that, because he also wants to elaborate on your basic point about, you know, the role of local governments and the role of the federal government.
I want to start with the issue that we all used to drive by these very large, high-rise places for poor people to live, right? They were
public housing.
And it was just awful.
Public slums.
In Chicago, we had them. And the problem with them wasn't just that they were bad. The problem was that we put them up everywhere in the country all at once. If anybody had looked at the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago for a few years, they would have never built Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis or its equivalent elsewhere. And I think that that's what we're beginning to see with experimenting state by state with different laws about dealing with drugs. You said, and in cities, you said in Crystal Lake that Nick was saying it's still criminal, but they've been thinking about maybe going to just giving a fine. Some cities are moving to fines. Some states have, in effect, decriminalized. If the federal government would back off a little bit, we could actually see whether tough laws in some states, easier laws in other states, decriminalizing in still others, which ones gave us the best results.
Jim, what about that idea?
I'm definitely in favor of ending the national and international prohibition on drugs and allowing the states and the individual nations of the world set drug policies in order to use them as laboratories to determine which are the most effective ways to control dangerous drugs. We know from what we've done the last 40 years that prohibition is the most effective way to put more drugs uncontrolled and unregulated everywhere.
And to build criminal organizations to distribute them.
Let's go to Mike in Cicero, Illinois on WLS Radio, talking coast to coast. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'd just like to ask Jim, you know, if he feels that it's easier in today's environment for a 15 or 16-year-old to obtain alcohol, or if he's marijuana or some other illegal drug.
That's easy. Everywhere I speak in the United States, the kids say that it's easier to get illicit drugs than it is to get a beer or a package of cigarettes. And the reason is because the person who's selling these controlled substances is worried about losing their license or being disciplined because they're violating the law. But you can go to a park or a school, right, and you can buy any kind of drug you want. You can go to any school and ask the kid, where can I get some cocaine, heroin, meth, PCB,
oh, we've all done that. But let me just say.
Got it.
Let me just say.
Speak for yourself, Professor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I actually had experience with this because when I grew up in high school, the state of Mississippi still had prohibition. You could get beer in some counties legally, but real liquor was illegal. And what we all did, different sheriffs had different policies depending on how much payoffs they wanted to take. So some sheriffs allowed moonshine. And if you didn't pay them, then they'd go out and bust you. But in two counties over, they allowed real liquor to come in. And you'd go there, and you'd go up to the door, and he'd say, are you 21? And we'd say, yes. And he'd just sell you as much liquor as you wanted. It was just as illegal to buy it when you were 16 as it was when you were 35. So there was a real problem.
Bob, in Chicago, you're on the air. Go ahead. Are you there, Bob?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is that I think the war on drugs can't stop because I think any doctor worth his weight would say that alcohol, tobacco do cause birth defects, but it takes a long, long time. Drugs, hardcore stuff especially, the crack, heroin, LSD, it can cause birth defects immediately. So it's not a victimless crime as far as unborn kids are going or having their lives affected by what's happening. And, I mean, is there a direct correlation? I can't say, but how much more is there? You're hearing the advertisements for autism, where it's just phenomenal amounts of autism. I'm not saying it's completely due to drugs, but I think that could be a big, big part of it. It's immediate.
All right, let's let Jim address that issue.
Well, the control of all illicit substances at the moment are in the hands of street gangs and drug cartels. They are the ones who decide what drugs are sold, where they'll be sold, what they're cut with, how strong they are, what the location of sale is, whether there's an age requirement. Those things are too important to allow gangs and drug people who are only interested in profit to decide. It would be better for government to control and regulate substances that we recognize are dangerous. By doing that, we take away the current message where drugs are cool, drugs are exciting. The Schaumburg police that got arrested said, why did you do this? It's exciting. And it gives them a chance to make money. Change the rules of the game so that now if you use drugs, you can go to a government facility and get the drug to which you're addicted so that you are, in effect, an addict who now has a government program where you can go and get the drugs for pennies without having to build the nation with prison spending $74 billion a year on our prison system.
Bruce in Austin, Texas, I think you want to pick up on that point listening to us on KLBJ. You want to legalize drugs because you think that it would generate taxes.
Well, I'm against the criminalization of possession. Only a fraction of those who possess are ever fingered for criminalization. And it's a discriminatory fraction at that. If you decriminalized possession and regulated the market, you would generate taxation. I am concerned about the impact on children. No doubt about it. Use can be bad for the children in the household. No doubt about it. I would, however, also say even if you decriminalized possession and you regulated the market, you would still have in place laws against driving while impaired, and you still have in place drug testing in employment and drug testing in schools.
This is really sensible. What you're saying, Bruce, is one of the most sensible calls we've had all evening. It recognizes that there's some downside, but it looks at the situation on balance. I don't think that the tax raising issue is actually a major it's a small plus, but I think that you put your fingers on it. I would add one other issue.
Can I just add one thing before you add a second thing, and that is on the education issue. You have basically said that all of the anti-drug TV spots that are used is, again, it's a way for radio and television stations to make a lot of money. Would you acknowledge, though, that if we were to move towards reducing this war on drugs or stopping it, would you also understand that there should be maybe an increase in the education in the schools about the dangers of drugs? Because you really, what I'm hearing you say as a father, and even at the beginning of your comment, you don't condone drugs. You don't want people to use drugs.
I'm absolutely opposed to drug use. Okay. But what we do now, we put police officers in the DARE program. And the kids who go through a DARE program with the police officer saying, these are drugs, this is how they're used, they're bad, don't do drugs. And this is marijuana.
So
this
you
is what
would
it looks
want,
like.
So you would want,
I don't
you
want
would
that.
Want, but you would want some drug education.
I want
Because you're
health
trying
teacher.
To convince kids not to try drugs.
I want the health teacher to be giving the lesson, to say there's lots of ways you can damage yourself. Don't smoke cigarettes.
Let's look at Chicago public schools and let's see how effective sex education has been. I mean, I just think that, when you start asking bureaucrats and teachers and administrators to handle what I think essentially is a very severe problem, we're going to get into trouble. And we talk about the government.
But you're asking educators to educate.
We are, but,
I mean, I remember when I went to high school, we had a course called health.
It just reminded me, as you were saying this, there's an old Cheech and Chong skit where the guys go in and they're the narcotics officers and they say, okay, we're going to show you examples of all the drugs. And they pass around the basket. And the basket comes back and it's empty.
It's empty.
So they say, we're not going to do anything. They pass it around. It comes back doubly full.
One of those two guys was sent to prison for actually owning a bong, I think it was. I mean, that's just lunacy.
Well, and again,
1-800-723-8029.
We
have to be back. 1-800-723-8029. One more segment. Got lots of callers, but there's room for you if you want to give us a call. I'm Bruce Dubon. Thanks for joining us tonight from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. Someone back in Chicago. We've got one more segment to go, but Jim Garrick, who is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, you soon are going to be going to Vienna along with other members of your board for this organization, and you are going to be testifying before the United Nations Subcommittee on Drug Policy.
Well, I will not be testifying, but I will be going to the 56th session of the United Nations Commission on Narcotics Drugs that meets annually in Vienna, which is the headquarters for the UN for illicit drugs. And this is the organization which is going to again reaffirm three prohibitionist drug treaties, which requires the 180-some members to go back to their nation states and outlaw, criminalize a list of drugs. And so now the United States is supposed to come back, and so we passed the Controlled Substances Act to the U.K., to all these countries around the world. And by requiring that criminalization, the United Nations is supporting the Al Capone prohibition model, which Al Capone supports, prohibition, because it's the foundation for the business. And around the world we have killings, corruption. In Mexico, they killed over 60,000 people in the war on drugs, sponsored by the United States in the Meridian Plan, which is just like the Plan Colombia, where we were given $400 million a year, that is killing people. We got the kids shooting each other, fighting over who's going to control the drug business on the streets of Chicago, and people are talking about gun control instead of the control of substances that feeds the gangs, that causes the shootings and the deaths.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Since we've been talking about the downside of the current system, are there any states, localities, or other countries that have policies that you think are better, and how are they actually working? Are they producing results so that we could at least go and look at them? I don't know what they are. The answer is yes.
Portugal is probably the best example, where in 2000 they decriminalized all drugs for small use. Crime is down. Drug use is down. Health has improved. People are employed, aren't committing crimes.
And they all learn Portuguese, right?
What about Amsterdam? Amsterdam has usually been pointed out as a city gone bad, gone to hell.
Amsterdam has for a long time said, we are not going to criminalize people who come to coffee shops where they sell marijuana, and you can order marijuana hashish off a menu. My daughter's been over there. I said, bring back me a menu. She said, they won't let you bring the menu, but she gave me a postcard of the menu. They're now concerned because people are coming from other countries. Drug tourism. So they come and smoke and say, well, we don't want them to do that, so we're going
it
to tighten
so
up.
It is so depressing.
Jim,
I have to tell you, I've been to Amsterdam. Yeah. It is a very depressing city because people are either lying in the gutter being stoned in the streets. Is very depressing. It's one of the most depressing. It's a beautiful city, but it's a very depressing city because you see the results of people who abuse drugs.
And unmotivated, there's a generation of unmotivated youth. I spent some time in Amsterdam as well. And, you know, nobody's working. Nobody's creating.
Creating.
But I think that's, you know, and that's, Bruce, there are long-term costs to a society of people that are on drugs.
Nick's got to.
And I just have to say, it's that type of moment. As a local elected official, I think we have a duty, a moral obligation, as you say, to say, do we want this? Do we not want this? The question I have for you, Jim,
do want to find out what happens in Portugal. I mean, because
I think Portuguese experience may be better than Amsterdam. And I guess I'm having trouble, Jim. And we were talking briefly during the break. Is this kind of this blanket approach of nothing? Is there anything that would be criminalized under your beliefs, or how might we look at this? How would we do this? How would it actually happen?
I think that we need to make rules that are appropriate for the substance. For example, in Switzerland, a heroin addict can go to the doctor and get a daily injection of heroin. Every heroin user is a crime wave, spending every minute trying to figure out how am I going to get the money to get the drug. And the drug dealer's charging too much. Something that should be pennies is enormously expensive. So what we need to do is to take a program like that, an addict alternative program, where someone, if you're addicted to heroin, you can come to us, the government. We will give you the drug under controlled and regulated circumstances, where we're going to use the drugs that we confiscate from the general public that are still illegal. We're going to trust and we're going to test the drug, the ton of heroin we got. Instead of destroying it, we'll test it at the crime laboratory, and we will use it to distribute to heroin addicts under controlled, regulated conditions. Their health will be better. There'll be less AIDS epidemic. Each new AIDS case costing $600,000 over the lifetime of the addict now because of the improved care for AIDS people. And the health of the people will be better. The crime will be reduced. There'll be less needs for jail. There'll be less support of the gangs. There'll be less shooting because there's less to fight over. We will have taken the addict's best customers.
We've heard the summary again. That's the wrap up.
Right, and
going
you know,
to the jury.
All right, Yeah, I'm going to posit a different example other than Portugal. Let's look at Indonesia, which has the death penalty for drugs, and we all hear the stories of the American caught with the drugs. Now, death penalty. Guess you know. I don't know what the numbers are, but I'll tell you what. Friends of mine, I traveled throughout Asia, throughout Africa, throughout Europe. Nobody did drugs when they were in Asia. It was low-key. People did not carry them. They did not transport them. They didn't buy them because they knew death. So, you know, you've got another side, and is maybe we're not strict enough.
All right. On that note, we are out of time. I would hope that this group would come back and pick this discussion up at some point, because, again, we had a lot of calls on it. I think it is an issue that touches a lot of people, and everybody seems to have an opinion on it. Our thanks this evening to James Garrick. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a former Cook County State's Attorney, Assistant State's Attorney. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago has joined us, also joining us this evening. We have Nick Kacharubas. He's a visiting assistant professor at DePaul University. And Stephanie Hitt joins us. Stephanie, always nice to have you with us, representing the conservative Republican and mother of four, who joins us tonight speaking as a mother. This program is a Gen B production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.